Welcome back to the weekly roundup with Diwa De Boer and William McGimpsey for Reality Check Radio. This show should be going out on Friday the 7th if you're listening to it. You might be listening to it a little later over the long weekend too. I am on holiday at the moment, so we're recording this just a little bit in advance, but better to have a slightly shorter weekly roundup than none at all, I think. So welcome back, William. It is good to see you in 2025.
Yeah, well, good to be back, Dee, with lots of big things happening, lots for us to talk about.
And there are three main things that I would like to cover in the time that we have. Basically, Trump's return and the focus on his foreign policy, what's happening overseas, and then the second thing I would like to cover, it ties into New Zealand, and we've obviously seen Trump deliver bigly in the last 2 to 3 weeks, and in New Zealand, less so. Trump has sort of deleted DEI and wokeness, and we see that things in New Zealand have stalled a little bit. The government is not doing what it could be doing, so we'll go into current hate speech issues, also the real estate. Is it also a real estate? I always forget their name exactly. It's like a real estate agents authority, kind of one of those silly names of silly departments. And they have won a case against Janet Dixon in the High Court, saying that she'll be banned for 5 years for not doing part of their diversity training, their cultural indoctrination. And then the final thing I'd like to cover is Waitangi Day, which has just happened, but it'll be for us the lead up to Waitangi Day, and in particular the bottom line that the Maori Party has delivered to Christopher Luxon to be part of a future government. So hopefully we get around to all of these three issues, and we'll start right with Trump's new foreign policy. Things have moved fast every single day, big changes. It's almost a full-time job to try and keep up with these things. Possibly, by the time that you're listening to this a day later, things have changed again. But we can quickly recap what he has done, going from basically threatening to take over Greenland, the Panama Canal, then Mexico, then Canada, and now he has moved on to Gaza. So your initial impressions on foreign policy?
Well, I think we can see now what he was really angling for with the discussion about annexing Greenland. That was a foreshadowing. It was a sort of softening up for the real meat and potatoes, the main dish, which is he's verbally annexed Gaza, right?
Yeah, and he did this in a press conference, in case anybody missed it. He just got up on stage and basically said, "We're taking over Gaza. The US is going to be administering Gaza." And who knows if that's what's actually going to happen. This could simply be a negotiating position. But that is a big change.
It's a remarkable thing to say. It's a remarkable thing to say. And I think, there's been this debate going on in the public sphere. What is Israel doing in Gaza? Are they, are they just sort of persecuting a war against Hamas? That doesn't really seem to explain all their military activity. And a lot of people, me included, have been saying, well, are they trying to ethnically cleanse them? And of course, when you say that, that's met with huge denials, and the claims of genocide are met with huge denials as well. But Trump has got up in this conference and said, we will annex Gaza and we will ethnically cleanse it on Israel's behalf. So there's no pretense anymore about what's going on here.
He didn't use the term ethnically cleanse. He said we're going to relocate the population. Is there a difference there, William?
No. No, there's no difference. That's what ethnic cleansing is, isn't it? You have an area, and there's a group of people in there, and you don't want them to be there, so you cleanse the area of them. You move them out, or kill them, or get rid of them in some way. So this is just a remarkable thing. It's refreshing that. What this has done is it sort of brought the whole discussion out into the open. Now, there's no pretense anymore about what's really going on here. Israel had a really tough situation there. They had a neighbor who really didn't like them very much, didn't want them to be there. And they were doing all sorts of, sniping attacks and terror attacks on them and things like that. It's a tough situation for Israel. However, those people were there before the modern state of Israel was set up, and the Israelis came in and basically annexed the land, seized it, drove them out with various types of terror attacks and things like this. And now they perhaps are wanting more territory. There is this thing called the Greater Israel Project, where they want to. The idea is that Israel would like to take more land for living space. That would include Gaza, include parts of the West Bank, and the Greater Israel Project even has greater territorial ambitions than that. And what it looks like here is that Trump is going to do the dirty work for them. He's going to move in. Presumably, this means American troops on the ground if they're serious. American troops, and Hamas is still there, so the American troops are going to have to be. If he's serious about this, the American troops will have to go in and fight the remnants of Hamas. If the Palestinian population doesn't want to move, presumably they have to be forcefully moved by Americans. Now, there's been a lot of trouble in trying to talk to a lot of these surrounding states like Jordan and Egypt to try and create a place for these people to move into because those surrounding countries don't want them either. The refugees from Gaza and from Palestine who have moved there have proven problematic for those countries in the past, I think. So they don't want to take them either. So if Trump can, so if Trump really wants to do this, he's going to have to make or persuade those surrounding countries to take those Palestinian people in some way. So this is, I mean, it's monumental that he would announce that. And if he's actually going to do it, it would be even more monumental still.
Well, that's the key thing here, right? So he's announced this. You've talked through what would actually need to happen. Now, we have known from the last few weeks that Trump uses these foreign policy announcements as a bargaining position, and he goes from there. And he hasn't actually annexed any territory yet, but he's got a whole bunch of concessions. He hasn't really placed actual tariffs on other countries, I think it, perhaps except for China, but see Mexico and Canada in particular, and there was Colombia as well. They all had the announcement that the tariffs were coming, and between 24, 48 hours later, the plans had all changed, and other states had stepped in, or the leaders had folded. Does it seem then like Trump is actually angling for something different? Because following this plan through to its logical conclusion, as you've outlined, is rather dramatic. It would be the total collapse of the post-war order. It would be the total collapse of international law, so-called. It would be the beginning of, I guess, a new kind of imperial age, like what we used to have in the 19th century, the 18th century. Some of my favorite parts of history. I would love to get to relive those, but to me, it feels like that's just a it's it almost feels like a step too far for most people, and that Trump himself is not necessarily going to go that far.
Yeah, well, you're right. He hasn't done any of this stuff yet. And he does use these big dramatic announcements as bargaining chips. So, he made the announcement he was putting the tariffs on, as you explain. And yeah, then he's using that to extract sort of, or to bargain, to get people to come to the table at least, and then bring troops to the border in the case of Mexico and all these other things. So perhaps that's what he's looking to do here as well. And it would be a good thing. I mean, ethnically cleansing a people is obviously bad, but the status quo is terrible too.
Exactly. And it's been like this for decades, right? It's been
That's
like
right.
this basically since the 1950s, 70 years of this kind of stalemate. Politically in Israel, it's been very impactful too, because the left wing has sort of ceased to exist because of this constant war with Gaza that's never ended. It's been very beneficial to Netanyahu, purely from a political perspective. For instance, he's facing internal issues like investigations into corruption, and being at war with Gaza, having Hamas there, has been something that's actively kept those domestic issues away from him. So this is not necessarily in his best interest to have this, say, completely resolved suddenly, because then he has to deal with his domestic issues, which are worse for him than dealing with war, external war.
I would just say, I mean, if this is the art of the deal, what does the United States get out of this? Let's just think this through. I mean, it would mean the US putting boots on the ground in Gaza, Taking the moral opprobrium that comes with like executing the ethnic cleansing plan, which at the moment falls on Israel, I cannot believe like what's going to happen to Gaza in the long term. Presumably, that's going to be given to Israel or sold in some
Well,
sort of
he's
deal.
really been pushing for Egyptian involvement. He wants Egypt and Jordan and Saudi Arabia to get involved, and they've said no. So this seems like it's designed to draw in those countries, those Arab states. He wants to bring them to the table. That would be my geopolitical analysis of that situation. And because the other issue that the US has as well is they pour insane amounts of money into Israel because of Gaza in particular. So all of that potentially could be stopped, right? So if he's thinking from this from a perspective of America getting bang for their buck, there are currently billions upon billions of dollars getting poured into Israel every single year for this. And he's sort of looking for the end game. He's looking for how do we end the war? It's something that he was elected on, promising to end the war in Israel and Gaza and Ukraine and Russia. It seems like he's gone full as drastic measures as he can, at least proposed as drastic measures as are possible to bring the different players to the table, because they're going to sit for the next 24, 48, 72 hours. They're going to be panicking, wondering what can we do to stop him from doing this?
And it's so, it's a monumental thing. It's really hard at this stage to say how it's all going to develop and unfold. But the great benefit of doing this, putting the moral issues with ethnic cleansing aside, the great and annexing, territory and all this stuff, the great benefit is that it's changing things, right? The status quo wasn't working in Israel and Gaza and the Middle East in general. This changes things. And if something's really bad and you change it, there's a chance it gets better. There's also a chance that it doesn't, that it gets worse or stays the same. But there's a chance now for things to improve in this region. And that's what I'm really interested in watching and analyzing moving forward.
Now, the next issue that we need to cover is how Trump has basically gutted the US aid program, which was sending billions of dollars, spreading all kinds of degeneracy around the globe, and all kind everything to do with the woke agenda, everything to do with DEI that was being funded around the globe, came out of this US aid program. Various other departments have basically had their all of their DEI officers fired. They've all been told, get rid of every single DEI program that you have, all this wokeness. It all needs to go. And in the space of 2 weeks, that's pretty much happened. There's a lot of follow-up still to go, but massive changes right out the gate. And then we come to New Zealand. So we see in America, even with their checks and balances, you can just do things. And Trump came in there and he just made a bunch of announcements, put a few key people into the right places and told them, get your departments under control. And that's what they did. Then we come to New Zealand, where we're now a year into the coalition government that was basically voted on a platform of national unity, getting rid of the divisiveness that we see around treatment of ethnicity in New Zealand law and New Zealand departments, how these diversity programs, DEI programs are pushed, a big backlash against that in the election. And we see that things have stalled. A big issue that came through the High Court this week was basically the loss of a judicial review that Janet Dixon made against the Real Estate Agent Authority, where they were going to ban her for 5 years, and they have now banned her for 5 years from practicing because she refused to do a course on tikanga and te reo Māori, and she said, that's not part of my job. And I looked into this very I didn't look into it very long. I knew the rough details here, and then I thought, oh, that's strange. Who's in charge of this department? And I saw that Nicole McKee and Paul Goldsmith, who's the Minister of Justice, they're actually in charge of this agency. And they've actually sent, in the case of Nicole McKee, she sent specific letters to the agency saying, you need to get rid of this program, just straight up saying, this program is not fit, you need to get rid of it. The law doesn't even require that program to be run. It's a decision made by the agency itself, by the authority. And they've ignored her. They've thrown the letter in the bin. They've carried on with this prosecution, persecution, I should say. And the people in charge are under the they can be appointed. They serve, basically they serve at the pleasure of the Minister of Justice. They can be appointed. New members could be appointed. Existing members could be fired. Nothing's happened. They've completely ignored a directive from the government. They've ignored the will of the people. And Nicole McKee and Paul Goldsmith have just left this agency in place. This authority is continuing to do what it's done, and the same with dozens of different departments running these programs. They're still doing it, and we know that it can be ended tomorrow. So what's going on in New Zealand? Why are we not just doing things like Trump is just doing things?
Well, that's a good point, but let me just take you back to the first thing you said. So, something that you and I have discussed in the past on this show a lot is the idea that personnel is policy. It's not enough just to know what your policy program is and go away and tell it to your subordinates and expect them to do it. There's been this whole big argument in the US about the deep state, right? And the deep state doing something different than what the president or the elected representatives want them to do, fighting back, refusing to implement the program. So, what you have to do is you have to remove the people hostile to your policy agenda from the bureaucracy and from these various other, quangos and the organizations around the show that exercise power.
In New Zealand, these are called crown entities. I should have mentioned that. So this whole real estate thing is a crown entity, and they're basically just controlled by the minister. So the minister gets to appoint who runs the agency. So they're under direct, easy control of government ministers. So they should be able to control the personnel if they wanted to, if they had the will to do so.
Yeah, but a lot of thought was Trump didn't do this in his first term, but a lot of thought was put into doing this in the second term. I remember the idea was Agenda 2025 or something like that.
Project 2025.
That's what it was, Project 2025. Trump distanced himself from it, but he's following through and doing the actual thing. He's got Elon Musk there with Doge or however you're supposed to say that, going through and looking at all these programs. And removing the diversity, equity, and inclusion people, so and which is just that's just a whole platoon of communists, basically, and all
Yeah,
these organizations
exactly. I mean,
who
these
are there to
radical
enforce
left-wing
this
extremists.
ideological orthodoxy. That's what they do
Yes.
in practice.
These are
So you.
again, these are ideological political extremists that are hostile to the current government, and they still get a paycheck, right? And they could all be fired tomorrow. It
Yeah.
could actually be done in New Zealand. The executive can just fire them overnight.
And so Trump is doing that. He's removing the diversity, equity, and inclusion people. He's putting some of his own people in, fewer, because hopefully they're more efficient and you need less. And that's the issue also with what you raised was that the USAID program. So there's people talk about globalism, but a lot of the power of globalism comes from this network of non-government organizations, these NGOs floating around that do various types of things, charity work. Development. They work on diplomacy, international relations. They promote various kinds of woke causes all around the world. And USAID funds a lot of these NGOs to do this stuff. And what it is, it's a huge left-wing or globalist patronage network paid for by the US taxpayer that in many cases is it's doing this stuff to other countries. It also reflects back and has impacts in the US. The El Salvadorian president, Nayib Bukele, put out a very good tweet pointing out that a lot of the people would rather not receive funding from USAID because it goes into organizations that foment chaos and disorder and protest and weird ideological things within their country, and only a small amount of it goes to actually practical things that help people. So for a long time, there's been this idea that the US has run its foreign policy on the idea of color revolutions, right? And a color revolution is where you send in your intelligence assets or your undercover people or some of these NGOs and they stir up various sort of protest movements. You've got your gay rights and you've got your minority rights and you've got your immigration lobbies and you've got all this sort of stuff. You put that in with funding from through USAID, through this NGO, this global complex, and then you can use that to sort of influence the direction of politics within countries. And that's a lot of what this USAID stuff has been doing. Now, a lot of Americans, maybe the majority voted for Trump, certainly seem to oppose that agenda. They would oppose the US doing this sort of stuff. They would oppose US taxpayer money going to do this sort of stuff. And that's what it does. So I think looking into that NGO complex, I'm sure there's some good things, but I think a lot of it, most of it, is probably this sort of ideological stuff, this sort of stuff of meddling in other countries' domestic policy. And you can probably cut a lot of that. It would do a lot of good around the world.
I wonder how much US aid is coming to New Zealand and which organizations, NGOs it has gone to. We don't have that information yet, but we will get it at some point and we will let you know. And I'm also thinking about a New Zealand equivalent in terms of the treaty. And we'll talk about Waitangi Day in a minute. But I think a lot of the treatyism and a lot of the agitation we see around the treaty actually comes from organizations that are funded by the New Zealand government. So this is not like organic protests or local people putting their money in together to fund these treatyist protests and foment racial disharmony in New Zealand. These organizations are getting your taxpayer money. And again, the government could fix that if they wanted to. They've had a year to see, see where the money's going. They could shut it all down. But for some reason, the National Party in particular seems to be happy to keep it going. Definitely something for New Zealand voters to think about and for us to dig into a little bit more because it seems very, very strange. And like we see in the United States, all you need is they've had Republican administrations. We've let this continue. Democrat administrations, we've let this continue. Trump, even in his first term, didn't know about it, basically, didn't know he had the power to stop it. He does now. And of course, so do we. We know it can be stopped as well. And that's very, very important.
Well, I guess the conspiracy is that a lot of people think that the many politicians are sort of in on this with this complex. They're in bed with the similar people. They're influenced by them. They're bought by them, perhaps, and or they're scared of them, alternatively, and they don't want to take on a fight that may cost them their political career. And so you've got all these types of incentives that might stand in the way of career politicians doing something courageous and attacking our powerful vested interests in the US government, because that they could and they would turn it around and go after them and perhaps end their political career. Trump is different. He's sort of an anti-fragile candidate who grows stronger as he's attacked. And so he can afford to do things in this different way, where he directly challenges a lot of these entrenched interests. He directly challenges these power structures, these patronage networks, and he shuts them down. In New Zealand, we don't have anything like that. I feel like our politicians are probably still fearful and scared in the same way that most of the US politicians prior to Trump and other politicians around the world too were scared of taking these interests on prior to Trump. One sort of ray of hope I have is we have the Manurewa Marae scandal interview, which is due to report shortly. And what it may reveal, and this is something I used to work in the public sector, I observed this firsthand, there's a lot of sort of Maori advisors and stuff like that, all threaded all through the public service. And anytime you want to do any sort of project, or you're asked to do any sort of project, you always have to consult these people and get these people on side. So it's impossible to do anything, to sort of follow the analysis where it leads, or do anything or challenge them or do something they don't like. They're always, intercepting all policy projects and sort of bringing them over and making sure they're not doing anything contrary to the Maori interests. And this stuff's threaded right through the public sector. There's agreements at the highest level of our public sector agencies with various iwi groups, Maori groups, etc. And provides serious conflicts of interest, I think. I mean, we have to really think about whether this is correct, or whether there's serious conflicts of interest from doing things in this way. My hope is that the Manurewa Marae scandal report back may bring some of that stuff to light. Perhaps I'll be disappointed, but perhaps it will. And if it does, then we can begin a process of trying to do something about it, which will maybe involve getting rid of some of these people.
And it's important to note as well that in the next election, which is going to be next year, we can encourage the political parties that are going to form the next government, the MPs, we can make them aware of these issues. We can encourage them to make it part of the coalition agreements in the future to say, we're going to dismantle this. We can have a full list of everything that needs to be dismantled in the same way that Trump and his team had all of this information ready to go. A lot of work can be done here in New Zealand to make sure that in a future government can actually solve this problem and do it quickly. That seems to be the key. Shock and awe, go after them all at the same time, one after the other, and they simply can't withstand the attacks. That seems to really be the key item. And this brings us to our final point of the week, Waitangi Day. As I said at the beginning, we're recording this just before Waitangi Day, but quite a few things have already happened in terms of politicians going to the Waitangi Treaty grounds, giving their speeches. The Maori Party has announced a bottom line that they want a treaty commissioner in charge of vetoing legislation that comes out of Parliament, basically like a dictator with veto power. That sort of seems to be the that's really what they're asking for, and who knows who that would be? Probably one of their guys. The end of democracy, some people have called it, and that's of course a strange bottom line to have for a political party. But the Maori Party has they've never been shy about it. They are opposed to democracy. So what does this mean for Waitangi Day? It's sort of become poisoned. I see a lot of hate for the day. Like, I mean, I'm just going on. I'm going camping, and I'm not doing any particular celebrations. I've seen. I would love to have do some New Zealand Day celebrations. I've seen some people call it that, and it's been a few years. I actually did with Right Minds NZ a local barbecue, hosting a barbecue, hosting a local patriotic event for a New Zealand Day celebration. You know, we could make that happen at the grassroots. But for the most part, people feel very negative. There's very people don't want to be associated with Waitangi Day, and all we get out of it is negative press.
Well, Shane Jones wrote an interesting op-ed where he said that Waitangi Day has become about politics, where it should be about community. And I think that's basically the thing. Politics has a corruptive influence wherever it comes into play. Politics is necessarily combative and divisive. And we used to have this idea of preserving, spheres in our social life that were free from politics to avoid that corrupting and divisive influence. And I think that that would really be part of the way to get Waitangi Day back and get some of these other holidays back. The issue that you have is if one side tries to politicize everything, then the other side either has to unilaterally disarm or go wade into the fight and politicize everything back. And so you're in a bit of a catch-22 situation because the
And it's an
left.
escalation. It's an escalation as well. We've seen it. It gets worse every single year because it has to get worse, because it's political.
That's right. And so that's sort of where we are and why that's happening. But the conversation around the what the Maori Party are wanting there, that's an interesting one. That would be appointing someone, a person that can review all legislation to make sure it's in line with the treaty. That would be a big change to our constitutional setup. There are, I mean, it would make us a bit more like the US, for example. The US has a constitution, and the elected members, even the president, is limited in what he can do. By the text of the Constitution, because the Constitution says the government has limited and enumerated powers. And when people think that the politicians are doing things outside their powers, they can take things to courts, and the courts can rule that yes or no, that the politicians are doing something they're not allowed to do. And this, what this is really doing is treating the treaty kind of like a constitution. And this would be a huge elevation in the status of the treaty. I mean, people have talked for a long time, particularly Maori, about the treaty being our founding document and it being really important and all this stuff. But really, in any sort of formal legal way, the treaty doesn't have a really important status. Judges have been trying to bring that into effect over time through these judgments.
And I just say that is because it's a treaty. A treaty is not a law. A treaty is not intended to be the basis of a nation. A treaty is essentially a kind of like a peace deal, or a list of concessions. All right, it's not a constitutional document. A treaty can't really be a constitutional document.
And that's what they're trying to make it into. But whether that would be, I mean, the issue is with what the treaty said. There are good and bad constitutions, right? And the issue is whether the treaty is really, appropriate and fulsome enough in describing all the rights and duties of that we think New Zealanders ought to have, and describing how our political system works and where the powers lie and all that sort of thing, to really give it that sort of status. And I think it's not really appropriate.
No, from history, that's evident in that after the treaty was signed, the was sent back to London basically, and then they sent back a charter from the Queen, and that charter outlined what the government should look like, and so that already tells you right off the bat that there was no possible way to run a government off the treaty, because the treaty wasn't about how to run a government. It was about basically, once we sign the treaty, we are then going to start running a government, and here's the charter from the Queen stating how the government will be run.
Yeah, but I mean, the point I was making there is that the opponents to what the, I mean, it's easy to take a reflexive anti-Maori party view, but a lot of countries are run that way, where they have like kind of a constitution, or they have someone, they have a Senate or multiple houses of parliament that review the legislative decisions of a lower body. So it's not a completely unprecedented thing, and there are many countries that we call democracies and call democratic that have things like that. It might not, I mean, if you had a good treaty, if you had a good treaty principles bill that wrote it all out quite well, what it meant, it could actually even be a good thing.
That's right. I mean, you never know, right? The ACT Party passes their Treaty Principles Bill, and then you get the Maori Party put the Treaty Commissioner in place who has to follow the Treaty Principles Bill. Well, that would be kind of funny, at the end of the day.
If we were conspiratorial thinkers, we might come to the conclusion that that's what the shadowy cabal of elites were actually trying to maneuver us towards.
It is a very strange situation, and we will be here on the weekly roundup throughout all of 2025. Breaking down the week's news for you. So thank you very much for listening to this episode, or perhaps watching this episode. We are going to try and do video versions of these. They will be available on demand. And who knows, maybe you're watching me right now, maybe you're not. Otherwise, check out in future weeks, and we will have that all running smoothly in due time. I appreciate you coming back on the show, William. It's been great to have this chat. And to all of the audience, we'll see you next time.
Thanks, Theo. It's great to be back.